Hey y'all, hope you have your hooks and yarn ready. Sorry if I sound a little off. I've been taking some pain medication, and tomorrow on November 23rd, I'm actually going to be having surgery. I'm recording this so that way I can get something out for y'all this week, and hopefully later in the week I can get some more out for you guys. This is kind of helping take my mind off of everything that's going on. So we are going to talk about Dennis Rader, the BTK murderer. Dennis Rader was born in Pittsburgh, Kansas. He was the eldest of four children, born to William Elvin Rader and Dorothea May Rader. He was baptized at the Zion Lutheran Church in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and his dad was a member of the Marine Corps and later worked for the electric utility KG&E in 1948. The family moved to Wichita, which is one of the largest cities in Kansas, and when Dennis was, you know, a youngin', he went to Riverside Elementary School, and he ended up graduating from Wichita Heights High School. Not a lot about Dennis's childhood is really known. Apparently he was in the Boy Scouts when he was a kid, and he admitted that he had developed fantasies of bondage, control, and torture from a very early age, like while he was still in grade school. You know, he dreamt of tying up girls and having his way with them. When he would imagine doing this, Annette Funicello, back from like way back, the original Mouseketeers, was one of his go-to, you know, people to imagine doing that to. He killed cats and dogs by torture and hanging. The people that actually knew him, you know, outside of this compartmentalized evil that he had, said he was quiet and polite and he kept to himself. You know, he wasn't very socially active. He had no interest in music or he didn't even have a sense of humor. He's very studious and focused. And he would give you his full attention as he, you know, like when you spoke to him, but he chose his words very carefully so that you had to have his full attention when he spoke. In 1963, he had graduated from Wichita Heights High School. And, you know, he worked at the, one of the IGA grocery store chains, because he worked in the meat department and his mama was a bookkeeper there. In fall of 65, he joined Kansas Wesleyan College in Salina. And it was a little bit too far from Wichita for him to live at home. And so he lived out there in Salina. And he only did two semesters before, you know, he turned 21 and joined the U.S. Air Force, where he served for 4 years. He was in Texas and Alabama and Okinawa and Greece and Turkey, and he, you know, kind of went everywhere for a little bit. And you know, his 4 years of active duty in the airport force were pretty unremarkable. He had gotten a couple little ribbons and whatnot. You know, he received the Air Force Good Conduct Medal, the Small Arms Expert Marksmanship Ribbon, and the National Defense Service Medal, and was discharged from active duty in the summer of 1970. and he went home to Wichita and served 2 more years in the reserves. You know, one guy that he had known from his Air Force days said that he was completely shocked when he found out that Dennis was a BTK, because he just kind of blended in. So after he gets back from, you know, serving in the Air Force, on May 22nd, 1971, Dennis Rader and Paula Dietz got married. Paula was from the same area, and they'd actually attended the same high school, and she was also Lutheran, which is how was Dennis's family's religious preferences, you know, they were going about their lives. Dennis was 26 and Paula was 23 when they were married, and they settled in Park City. It was a little bit, Park City is a suburb of a little bit north of Wichita, and, you know, they didn't live too far from his parents. Dennis, you know, was working at the meat market. Paula was a bookkeeper, so Dennis had went back to working at the meat market, or meat department, I'm sorry, of the IGA supermarket. In 72, Rader went to work for the Coleman Company. They make camping supplies and at the time was one of Wichita's largest employers. He stayed there for just over a year, until July of 1973. And he was attending Butler County Community College in El Dorado and earned an associate's degree in electronics in 1973. In the fall of 73, he began studies at Wichita State University, and it was, you know, 6 more years of night school before he earned his degree. He was a poor student, and he basically rode C's and D's all through school. He couldn't spell for anything to save his soul, and, you know, he may have had an undiagnosed learning disability, and it was reflected in his really, really bad grammar and horrific spelling. So, you know, in 73 to 74, he worked for Cessna aircraft manufacturer for a bit. Apparently he was fired, and he found himself depressed, and he slipped deeper into his fantasy world and wanted to know what it would feel like to strangle someone to death. So, thus begins the work of him becoming BTK. In January of 1974, Dennis Rader was, you know, he was in between jobs. His wife worked at the VA hospital in Wichita and didn't like driving in the snow and ice, so Dennis would drive her to work, and then pick her up from work. He enjoyed what he would call trolling, which was him driving around or walking around certain neighborhoods or school campuses, and he would find women to, check out and see if they would be a good prospect, sorry, to, enter into his little fantasy realm of, you know, torture and bondage and death, and, you know, start fantasizing about what he would do to them. On the corner of Edgemore and Murdoch in Wichita, there was a new family that had moved in, and one day while dropping Paula off at work, Dennis saw Julie Otero. She was a lovely 34-year-old lady, and her daughter, Josephine, who was 11. And he said that he, quote, had a thing for Hispanic women. So Dennis decided that he had to have them. Okay. So he gets a hit kit together. It had, you know, a gun, cords, knives, tools for breaking and entering, And he started watching the Otero house for a while, getting an idea of when people left and got back and what their schedule was like. So on the morning of January 15th, 1974, you know, he couldn't wait any longer. He was overcome with this urge that he had to go in there and he had to, you know, have Julie. And so it was 8 a.m. He had dropped Paul off at work. He came around the back of the house and snuck into the yard and cut the phone line. He wasn't sure if he could go through the back door, but when he barged in, things weren't like he thought they were going to be. Joseph Otero, Julie's husband, he was 38, and he was still at home, and so was Julie, Josephine, their son Joey, who was 9, he was Joe Jr., and their dog was in the house. So Raider, because the Otero family actually had 3 other children, but they were not at the house. They had Charlie, Daniel, and Carmen, who the only way that they survived was they were at school. So Raider tells them that, you know, he is on the lam and he needs money and he's here to rob them. And, you know, that's how he got control of the situation. He ordered Joey to put the dog in the backyard. And, you know, he was able to control all 4 people by using the gun. And he told them he was, you know, he needs money and food and a car to get out of there. So, you know, Joseph is like, well, why the hell are you doing this? Like, is this a joke? Did my brother-in-law set you up to this? And Dennis was like, no. So he orders everyone to lay down on the living room floor, and then he changes his mind and he sent them all into a bedroom. By using this ruse, he was able to, you know, kind of get the Oteros off kilter enough to, you know, they were surprised and kind of not at their best wits enough to get them all tied up. So, you know, he put a bag over Joseph Otero's head. And Joe, he was trying so hard to fight for his life. He was tearing holes in the bag with his teeth. And Raider had to use a cord as a ligature to kill him. You know, he tried to manually strangle Julie, but, you know, as anyone who knows anything about true crime knows that it's not like the movies where they choke you for, you know, 30 seconds or whatever, and then you're gone. You know, your brain kind of go into almost like a stasis, and then when the oxygen's able to come back in, you're gonna come back. So, you know, I guess Dennis didn't realize this at the time, so he had choked Julie until she passed out, but then she kept reviving, and you know, she kept begging Dennis, please don't kill the children, please don't kill the children, may God have mercy on your soul. Little Joey was the next one that was killed. Dennis got Joey to go into his bedroom, and he strangled and suffocated the boy. Apparently, Joey had rolled off of his bed and died face down on the bedroom floor. And Raider admits to bringing a chair into the bedroom and sitting there to watch the boy suffocate to death. I hate talking about the details of what happened to this. So I'm just kind of giving brief details. There are far more in-depth details if you read some of the books about him. And this one, like, really gets me. So Josie, well, Josephine, she was 11, and he tried to strangle her, but she was revived. And he made her walk down to the basement, and he tied a noose and put it around her neck. And when she asked what's going to happen to me, he said that she would be going to heaven to join the others and her family. And then he asked if her dad had a camera, and she said that they didn't have one. And so Josie was hanged from a sewer pipe in the basement, molested by Dennis, left partially unclothed, and he masturbated over her bare legs, leaving some semen on the pipe and on her and on the floor. I'm sorry, that I hate that. He stole some things from their house, but he masturbated while he watched this tiny 11-year-old girl die, and that just, oh my god. Anyway, so, you know, Raider kind of ransacked the house. He took Joe's watch and a radio, and he got into their car and backed it out into the street and dropped it off in a Dillon's is a supermarket chain in Kansas, into a Dillon's supermarket, and parked the car and left. A lady saw him leaving the car, and he was apparently shaking like a leaf. And he tossed the car keys into the roof of the Dillon's, and left the area on foot. So he claims that he walked to his own car, but then realized that the knife was missing that he had. And apparently he went back to the Otero house, parked his car in their garage, and then went in and got his knife back. Raider didn't know that he didn't know that the Oteros had three other kids, because they all left for school by time, you know, he would get done dropping Paula off at work and going back around to where their house was. So Charlie, Daniel, and Carmen, they survived, and the only reason they did is because they were at school. Daniel and Carmen actually came home before Charlie did, and they found their parents the way they did, and the, you know, deceased, obviously, rigor had started to set in, and they were screaming and freaking out when Charlie walked in the door screaming, "I think Mom and Dad are trying to play a bad trick on us." And of course, it wasn't a bad trick. Carmen attempted to cut through the bonds of her parents' bindings while Charlie ran out and called a neighbor. And when the police arrived, he begged the officers to not let Joey or Josie come home to see what had happened. And the officers had to tell him and his siblings that their two siblings that were home were dead. So yeah, they ended up actually going to live in New Mexico with an army buddy of their dad's who got custody of them. And then, so I don't want to give too much detail. I'm not going into like the super, super, super detail. There are some books I'll recommend at the end of this that, I had read from, or well, not read from, but that I'd read, in regards to this case. And then there was there's a BTK documentary that I got on Amazon Prime. I purchased it, and I watched it, and I learned some, you know, more things on there. I don't want to get too graphic with this one. This man really unnerves me, and I think it's just because, you know, like I said, that the whole way he's able to go do these horrific things and then go back home like nothing's happened, that's very unnerving to me. So we'll fast forward to April 1974. Dennis, it was April 4th, and Dennis had been stalking a woman named Catherine Bright. She was 21. And, you know, one day he had seen her going into her house, and he thought she was going to be a great victim. So, you know, he breaks into her home via the back door, and he had cut the phone line, and he hid in a bedroom. So around 2 o'clock, Catherine comes home, but her brother Kevin, who was 19 at the time, was with her. Kevin didn't live there, but, you know, he went to, with his sister do some errands into the bank, and Rader scared them by coming out of the bedroom and pointing a gun at them. So, you know, he tries to tell them the same story that he tells the Oteros, that, you know, he's a wanted criminal. He's trying to get out of there. He needs a car. He needs some money. He forces them into a bedroom, and Catherine's tied up by Kevin. There's two versions of the story. He was either tied up, or she was either tied up by Kevin being forced at gunpoint, or by Rader himself. There's, you know, conflicting stories on that. And then he, being Dennis, tried to tie Kevin up in another room, but he hadn't brought his best, quote, hit kit materials that day, and had to improvise with materials he had found in the house. And Kevin worked his way out of the bonds and got into a fight for his life with Rader. And he almost took the gun from Dennis, but Dennis was able to get the gun back, and he got off a shot that hit Kevin in the face. But Kevin, he's a tough dude. He's still fighting. And, he got shot a second time in the head, while he was trying to overpower Rader, and he was stunned and he was bleeding. And so, you know, he appeared to be dead or dying. So Dennis went back to, do what he had wanted to with Catherine, but she was a fighter too. And in order to end the scene quickly, Rader switched from, you know, trying to strangle her to stabbing her. And he killed her with deep cuts to the abdomen and other areas. While this is going on, Kevin had, you know, kind of come to and ran out of the house. He's screaming for help. And so this made Rader have to, you know, like, he had to book it, man. He had to get the hell out of there. And he ran from the scene on foot. He got, you know, to his car that was parked a few blocks away, and he drove off. And by the time it was time for him to pick up Paula from work, he was all cleaned up and no one suspected him. Catherine died a few hours later, in the hospital, even though they had tried with surgery and blood transfusions to save her. Kevin was in critical condition, but he survived, and he still has some damage that was done to him that day. And, you know, I feel like that would be a pretty hard thing to live with. You know, it's great that Kevin made it out and was able to survive and get help. But it's very tragic that Catherine passed away the way she did. So in October of 1974, an editor of the Wichita Eagle newspaper got a phone call that directed him to a letter that was hidden in an engineering book in the Wichita Public Library. So he calls, you know, this editor calls the police, and they found the letter in the library, and it was a gruesome, like, not planned, like, very gruesome depiction of the unsolved Otero murders. And it, of course, had to have been done by someone with a, quote, good knowledge of the crime scene. It was written in poor English with a crap ton of misspellings. The writer was concerned that the police had arrested the wrong men for the Otero murders and then proudly proclaimed, "I did it myself with no one's help. The code words for me will be bind them, torture them, and kill them." Signed it BTK. So he gave himself his own, you know, little nickname, which is just, isn't that just the cutest? Actually not. I think it's pretty gross, but you know, I truly cannot stand Dennis Rader. So, you know, he's working his job at ADT, and, you know, he found that he had a lot of, flexibility in where he could be during the day. So, you know, he would use that time to stalk different women. And then in 1975, Brian, his son was born, and between the schedule with ADT and night school at WSU, he, you know, didn't do anything, any known crimes, I should say, between 75 and 76. And, you know, he was still trolling for victims, but, you know, he just didn't have time, I guess. And then on March 17th, 1977, he decided that, you know, he had to kill someone. He couldn't deal with it anymore. So he was gonna, you know, he was gonna kill someone. He had been, you know, quote, trolling a particular neighborhood, you know, pretty heavily, and, found some women there that took, you know, he took an interest in. He met a woman named Cheryl in a bar, and, you know, he was kind of interested in murdering her. But she was, renting a house with another woman and had parties, and, you know, he decided that he was going to kill her. And, you know, fortunately for Cheryl and her friends, no one was home when Rader came by that day. And Rader also has stated that he, you know, cased another home in the neighborhood, but no one was there either. So that's probably pretty lucky for them. So at one point he goes down, foot down a road called Hydraulic Street and runs into a 5-year-old Stephen Relford. He pulls out a photo of his own wife and son and asks Steve if he knew who they were, and Steve said no. And he went on home to his mama was sick, and so he had gone up to the grocery store to get her a can of soup, and then, you know, he was going on back home to give mama the soup. And soon, you know, there's a knock on the door, and Steve answers the door and realizes that it's the guy he had the picture, you know, that had the picture showed to him before. You know, at this time, Dennis decided he was going to pose as an official person and, you know, tries to fool the little boy, as saying he's a detective and get, you know, he's able to get into the house that way. Well, he didn't know that there were three other children home, or that there were three children in the home, including Steve, I'm sorry. There's an 8-year-old brother and a 4-year-old sister, and Rader abruptly just, like, turned off the TV and lowered the blinds, and, you know, Shirley Vian, their mama, comes out in a bathrobe, and she had been sick, and she wanted to know what the hell was going on. And at gunpoint, Rader ordered all of the children into the bathroom, where he moved the bed against the bathroom door and locked his way in. The other bathroom door was tied to the sink, with the handle, so these kids couldn't get out. But he, you know, made his intentions clear to Shirley that he was going to tie her up, rape her, and, yeah, but that's not exactly how it happened. He didn't rape her as he had let her believe. You know, he said that she had thrown up and he got her a glass of water and even gave her, you know, let her have a cigarette so she could calm down. And you know, her, you know, she knew that her common-law husband, Richard Vian, wouldn't be home until way later. So, you know, she was kind of trying, I feel like in a way she was kind of, you know, trying to extend time, but he did end up tying her up and then strangling her to death with a cord around her neck. He left semen on her panties that were next to her body. And he was gone before the kids, you know, break, you know, they were able to break out of the bathroom. Steven actually has said that he was able to get the bath, he and his brother and sister were able to get the bathroom door open, just a crack, and he saw everything that happened to his mother, and that just breaks my heart. Rader said that he had not been able to cut the phone line at the Vian house. Either he forgot or just, you know, wanted to get in there and get it going. And the phone ringing kind of spooked him a bit and it made him leave before he could kill the children. So I guess that's lucky for those kids in a way, but also not, because they have to live with the fact that they know, you know, their mother was murdered and poor Steven saw it happen. So fast forward again to December 1977. Dennis, you know, got all obsessed with 25-year-old Nancy Fox and was stalking her from her residence to her work. And the evening of December 8th, he broke into her duplex and he got in through, he got the phone lines and he got in through a rear bedroom window. He waited for her to get home from her job at a jewelry store where he had actually gone and purchased some cheap jewelry for his wife before. Nancy was the only person that lived in this duplex. The other side was empty and awaiting new renters. And so, you know, Dennis confronts Nancy in the kitchen and, you know, he says that, you know, he had a sexual, quote, sexual issue and needed to tie her up to rape her. And, you know, other than, you know, being kind of a bitch to him, which is she had every right to be, Nancy didn't really fight back. She was ordered into the bedroom after being allowed to partially disrobe in the bathroom. Rader tied her to the bed and undressed the, you know, undressed himself. At that point, he announced who he really was and made it clear that he was the same person who had killed the Oteros and proceeded to strangle her to death. He left semen deposited on the nightgown found next to her body. The next morning, after reporting to work at ADT, he left the office in the company van. Rader was stopped at a phone booth a couple blocks. He stopped at a phone booth a couple blocks down the street. He dialed 911 and said, and I'm quoting, "Yes, you will find a homicide at 843 South Pershing, Nancy Fox," and left the receiver dangling. People also, you know, it went for a while that people thought it was very weird that instead of saying homicide, he said homicide. You know, nobody really knows why he said it that way. But police went and rushed to the evidence and they found her, or the residence, I'm sorry, and they found her, you know, dead, lying in the bed. Her head was badly swollen. The tape that was, you know, recorded of that call was played over and over and over again by Wichita media, but no one was able to recognize his voice. I mean, not even his coworkers or his family, and I find that pretty odd. In early 78, Rader attempted to send a postcard with a sarcastic poem, Shirley Locks, to the Wichita Eagle, but no one recognized the significance of it until, you know, a few days later. Then it was followed by a letter that was taken very seriously. In it, the killer, you know, takes full responsibility for the Oteros, the Shirley Vian and Nancy Fox murders, and plus an unnamed seventh victim that, you know, was, of course, was Catherine Bright. The writer says that, you know, he has, you know, a few names that he would like, including BTK, which, you know, ultimately is what he deems himself, and the, you know, media and the police call him. So, yeah, he also mentions his Factor X, which is what he said was his reason and his need to kill people. To me, that's his compartmentalization of his evil side, where he had to kill and rape and attack and, you know, torture these people, versus the side of him where he could go home and be a loving dad and a family man. And, you know, his wife and two kids had no idea what was going on. People he worked with had no idea what was going on. So, you know, in these letters, the Wichita Police Department, they, you know, decided that it would be announced that they had an unknown serial killer on the loose. And citizens were urged to be extra careful about locking their doors and looking out for each other. And so there was an entire generation of women that grew up in Wichita that routinely checked their phone lines for a dial tone, to make sure the phone line hadn't been cut. And if you didn't have a dial tone, you got the fuck out of there. So, in June 1978, Paula Rader gives birth to their final child, Carrie. And in April 1979, Rader broke into the home of Anna Williams, a 63-year-old widow who had very recently lost her husband. He waited and waited and waited hours for Anna to come home, but she didn't until way later in the evening, and Rader actually went and stole a few things from her house. So in June of that year, you know, a few days before his graduation from WSU, Anna receives a package in the mail with a poem entitled, "Oh Anna, Why Didn't You Appear?" and a drawing of what Rader had intended to do with her and a few of the things he'd stolen. The next day, a similar package arrived at the studios of KAKE-TV in Wichita, and Anna was terrified, and she moved the hell out of Wichita. So we're going to take a break for a second, do our sponsor spots, and then we will be right back. Hey y'all, so if I get a stupid haircut, I will throw a hissy fit. So I went and saw Miss Allison Crawford, and let me tell y'all something. I walked out of the salon and I started crying because my hair looked so beautiful and I felt beautiful. And I will never, ever, ever go to another stylist again. So if you want to look and feel beautiful too, hit her up at 909-289-9685 or follow her on Instagram at all lowercase Allison, A-L-L-Y-S-O-N _ Crawford, C-R-A-W-F-O-R-D _ hair, H-A-I-R. And y'all, tip her well. She deserves it. She's just freaking awesome. Y'all, our crochet spotlight artist is Stephanie Picorni. She is the freaking crochet queen of Halloween. And let me tell y'all, Googler. Her costumes are amazing. Her kids look badass every single year. Like, I am in awe of her work. So y'all should follow her at facebook.com/crochetverse, ravelry.com/stores/crochetverse, crochetverse.com, at crochetverse on Instagram, etsy.com/shop/crochetverse. And seriously, she's amazing. Y'all Google her and or go on any of these and look at her kids' costumes. They're the freaking coolest. Okay, and we're back. So now at this point, you know, Dennis is loving all this publicity that he was getting in the late 70s. And, you know, he was getting a little bit more wary of being caught. you know, he... Yeah, there was one letter that was officially acknowledged that did not come from BTK. But otherwise, you know, he's still stalking women through neighborhoods and, you know, all the while he is becoming more active in his church and a Boy Scout leader. And, you know, when his son was old enough, Brian, you know, his son would become a Eagle Scout and was in Boy Scouts. And, you know, Rader didn't utilize his degree in administration of justice from WSU, but was known to have envied becoming a police officer and was reportedly involved at times in reserve officer programs as a volunteer. So nobody understands why Dennis Rader is, you know, a psychopath. There's nothing in his childhood that, you know, would have set off anything like that. He said his mom was a little distant and his dad worked a lot, but, you know, he didn't have anyone that beat the hell out of him. And even if he did, honestly, there's so many people that go through life having shitty childhoods that don't turn into fucking serial killers. So, you know, he is a complete, like, sociopath. He has no empathy for others. He's self-centered and narcissistic, and nothing and no one else matters unless they serve a purpose for him. And, you know, he's, like I said, he was very, very great at compartmentalizing his worlds. He had his home world where he could go and be dad of the year, you know, Boy Scout leader, you know, head of the church, whatever. And then he had his other world where he would go home and steal, you know, he would go to different homes and steal women's underwear, murder people, and molest them. And to him, it was like, you know, changing the underwear, changing socks. Like, it was just such a quick switch. So by 1985, you know, no one knows that, you know, nobody really knows what's going on with BTK. He's busy being a family man, and, you know, he didn't have a criminal record. He's very religious and he worked in his church. And, you know, at this time he's 40 in 1985, and his son's 9 and his daughter is 6, and he needed to kill someone at this point. So instead of going outside of where, you know, close to where he lives, he decides to kill a neighbor that lives up the street from them in Park City, Maureen Hedge. A woman was 53. She was a widow, and she was a small, little friendly gal. She had 4 grown children, and Rader, you know, the Raiders had lived in a home over on Independence Street, and during walks, Dennis and Paula would wave at, you know, Maureen, who enjoyed gardening, just like Dennis enjoyed gardening. So on the weekend of April 27th, 1985, Rader was attending a Boy Scout camp out just outside Wichita. He left the camp in the evening, saying that he had a headache and he needed to go to town and, you know, buy some Advil or whatever. What he actually did was parked his car by a bowling alley in the city, bought himself a beer, swished the liquid around in his mouth, and spit it out. And he also spilled beer on his clothes so he would smell like he had been drinking. He called a cab and pretended to be drunk and told the driver to take him to a park in Park City so he could walk it off before going home. The park actually, you know, was adjoining to the backyard of the Hedge property, so Rader was disappointed to see Maureen's car in the carport and assumed she was home. But he still went and he cut the phone line and quietly pried open the back door using a screwdriver. But it turned out that actually no one was home. Rader goes and hides in a bedroom closet, and a little bit later, Maureen and her friend Gerald Porter came into the house. Gerald left for the night around 1 a.m., and Rader waited while Maureen went to bed and fell asleep. He then creeps out of the closet, flicks the bed or the bathroom light on, and pounced on Maureen in the bed, manually choking this tiny 100-pound woman to death. So his fantasy is not even fulfilled yet. It is far from over. He drags her body with the bedding from her bed into her own car and put her in the trunk. He drives to his church, where, you know, obviously he's trusted. He has keys to the building, and he drags her body beneath some trees and enters the building down in the basement where he had taped black plastic over the window so no one could see inside. He drags her into the basement of the church and photographs her deceased body in various sexual poses. It's getting late, and he knew that the Boy Scouts would be getting up pretty soon. So he puts her body back in the car, and takes off. He found a dumping place in a ditch along a dirt road a few miles outside Park City, and dumps Maureen's body, and kind of half-ass covers her with some, you know, like ground stuff, like leaves, twigs, whatever. And then he left knotted pantyhose by the body, which had been used for, you know, whatever that night. I don't know if he used it to gag her, choke her or what. I'm not sure why that was left there, but he left it there. And, you know, he, he drops the car key to her car onto the dashboard, and the key slid down and got stuck between the windshield and the dash, and he had to use a rock to smash the corner of the windshield so he could get the key back so he could drive her car back. So he, you know, it's dawn is coming up, and he speeds his way back to where he left his car in Wichita. He parks Maureen's car there and he wipes it down and returns to the scout camp trip. And, you know, he wasn't connected until the crime until over 20 years later, but he had photographs of her in his possession and his weird fucked up collection of trophies that he has taken from people that he's murdered. In September of 86, Rader decides that Vicky Weggerly, a 28-year-old mother of two, would be her next victim. So on September 16th, he decided to take some time out to go to her house. It's about 10 a.m. He shows up at her door dressed like a telephone repairman, complete with a hard hat, everything. He manages to convince Vicky to allow him inside to check the phone line, He fiddled with her phone using an improvised testing gadget that he had made to look legit, but obviously wasn't. And then he told her he was going to tie her up. It's presumed he used a gun to force her into a bedroom and tie her up, but she fought him and scratched him, and, you know, he was able to beat her in a physical fight and tie her down, and then he strangled her to death using pantyhose. He photographed her dying body in a few poses and then left in her car. Vicky warned him that her husband would be home shortly after, and Rader later said that the husband, or that had the husband come home, he would have been killed too. So, you know, Bill Weigerly did come home after, and he saw his car going in the opposite direction from the house, but he couldn't identify the driver, but it didn't look like Vicky. Their 2-year-old son, Brandon, was in the living room unattended at this time. I don't know if Dennis knew that Brandon Weigerly was in the home, but, Bill, he couldn't find Vicky at first. And, that is because she, when she died, she had fallen off of the bed and was between the floor and the bed. and Bill was in the house for about 45 minutes to an hour before he was able to find her body. She was rushed to the hospital with paramedics trying desperately, you know, to revive her, but she was pronounced dead shortly after. So Dennis had driven around the city for a while disposing of evidence and then returned to the area near the house and parked the Weigerly's car a couple blocks away from their home. As he left the area on foot and returned to his own car, he changed clothes, escaping all detection for this crime, and was never suspected of it. Bill Weigerly was, you know, his life took a crazy-ass turn. So he loses his wife and the mother of his children. But then he was also faced with suspicion from the police and the public, who were not satisfied that he was innocent of this crime until, you know, BTK confessed to it like 18 years later. But since no one had heard from BTK in like 8 years, the police just were like, nah, this is not a BTK crime. That guy's gone. We don't know what happened. And even though no formal charges were ever put against Bill, it still left, you know, this whole deal of his kids were told, oh, your dad killed your mom. And so the kids grew up hearing these horrible things that were completely untrue because of Dennis Rader. So, yeah, they're, the next crime that occurred, well, one of the next things that happened to Rader was in 1988, I swear, y'all. You know, he got himself fired from ADT. His official reason of that was stated by the company was he was not getting his work quota done. And then, you know, his co-worker said that he was very difficult to work with, but he was customer oriented. And, you know, he had wanted to be a cop. He thought that being an alarm installer was an inferior position. And, you know, at this point, it doesn't really matter because he was out of a job. And so in 1989, oh my lord, I should just take a nap. He worked for a few months as a field operations supervisor for the U.S. Census Bureau. And then otherwise he was unemployed or working temp jobs until he got a new position in 1991. So we get to 1991 and, you know, Dennis has decided he found that older women were easier targets. You know, these younger gals, they fought back. He was getting older. Men were just obstacles that were in the way of, you know, what he wanted to get done. So he kind of focused on older, widowed ladies. And he found a woman who lived alone. She was 62-year-old Dolores Davis. And she only lived about a mile and a half from where he did. But there's, you know, nobody knows if they were acquainted or not. So Dolores had moved to Park City after, you know, years of being an executive secretary in Wichita and was renting a house in the area. And she didn't have very close neighbors. And so, of course, Dennis is like, oh, hell yeah, this is great. And he noticed her at home one day and, you know, he was doing some snooping and checking around to make sure that she was a single woman that was living alone. And of course, you know, this would have to be another very well-planned, quote, project, is that's how he referred to the heinous crimes he committed. They were all projects. So he used the pretext of being away for the weekend on a scout camping trip outside Harvey County, just north of Sedgwick County, where Rader and Miss Davis lived. And so he, you know, goes up there and he sets up the camp half-assed and says, oh, me and y'all, I gotta go back to town and finish getting stuff together, you know. So it's really cold, and he leaves the camping trip. He drives back to his parents' house in North Wichita, because apparently they were gone that weekend. He changes out of his scout uniform into his hip clothes, and then he drives to the Baptist church in Park City, parks his car, and sets out for Dolores' house on foot. When he got there, she was still awake, but she was reading in bed, and he waited out in the cold for her to turn off the light and go to sleep. He then used a cement block taken from the shed in the backyard and smashed the sliding glass door in the rear of the house. Dolores, scared to death, thinking somebody drove into her house, comes out of the bedroom, and there's Dennis. He launches into his, you know, familiar line of, oh, I need food and money and a car, and I'm trying to get away from the law, and, you know, I have to tie you up. So, you know, there are indications from the crime scene that a struggle did take place, but Rader succeeded in tying her up in the bedroom. It's not known how long Rader was there, but Dolores helped to ruin the party by telling him she was expecting someone to arrive any minute. He killed her by ligature strangulation, and Rader made a sketch of her final moments, you know, right very soon after the murder. He then drags the body and of Miss Dolores out to the trunk of her car. He drives a short distance to a lake that's nearby off of, I-135 in Park City, and, leaves the body there and some other evidence just by some trees. He drives the car back to her house, wipes down fingerprints, tosses the keys onto the roof, and set out on foot, walking in a roundabout fashion back to the Baptist church. Then driving his own car, he returned to where he left the body and put it in his car. He then meanders around the north and settles on a more remote spot underneath a bridge in North Sedgwick County as the dumping spot. After leaving her there, he went somewhere to change back into a scout uniform and return to the camp. And then the following night, he left the camp again to go back to the dumping spot to pose and photograph Miss Dolores' body. He said that he had an encounter with a police officer at a place where he had to change clothes, but was left go after a few questions. And then after, you know, the murder, Rader took a photo of himself buried in a grave. He said he had dug for Dolores Davis wearing a mask and using a Polaroid camera activated with a mechanism triggered via cord. Yeah, that's pretty fucked up. I've seen some pictures of this man and just some absolutely disgusting, like, everybody's got their kinks, okay? I'm not trying to kink shame, but just some absolutely disgusting positions. And one of the, you know, the picture of him that is like this I've seen online, and y'all, it's fucking gross, to be quite honest. So, you know, the next night, he, after he had taken these pictures and stuff, oh no, I'm sorry, not the next night. I'm skipping ahead of myself. So 4 months after this happens, you know, he's hired by Park City as a compliance and animal control officer. And he became a, you know, kind of combination dog catcher and local code enforcer because this branch for the, you know, the city was so small that they only required 2 people to work it. And so, of course, Dennis has his position of power. So, you know, he starts being a complete and total dick to everybody. If your grass was too tall, he would give you a code. You know, if your dog was out, there was complaints of him that he had euthanized dogs where, you know, there was no need for that to happen. You know, sometimes he could be nice. Sometimes he was overzealous and petty and would write citations to people, you know, about their grass, fences. There's one instance where apparently there were some police officers. This is in one of the books that I had read about Dennis Rader. There are some police officers that were helping a buddy of theirs, I believe, fix a roof. And the guy who works at the, he was a police officer as well, got told off by Dennis Rader for not having a building permit. So yeah, he took his job very seriously. So, you know, there were people that were said to have moved away from Park City just because of the way he acted. No complaint ever resulted in a disciplinary action. And, you know, local officials would usually side with Rader when it came to dealing with citizens because, you know, nobody really wanted the job that he had. And he was trying to, you know, keep it going, I guess. But, so there is one case on record that went to court where a woman contested a $25 fine levied against her by Rader over dog control. So Rader had showed up in court with a bag, a half inch thick, full of official documents and won the case. But, you know, there's another woman that said that she had a very disturbing story about Dennis. You know, there was no problem with him and her. He was very nice to her until she got a boyfriend. And, then, you know, Dennis started issuing so many citations against her and basically told her that, you know, if she got rid of her boyfriend, then this would stop. You know, there was one day the boyfriend was working on a vehicle in the driveway, and, you know, they received a citation for that. There was one day that Rader was looking in her windows and was examining a door that was mysteriously broken. But it all kind of went bad when Rader impounded
this girl's daughter's dog, and it was put to sleep before anyone could reclaim it. And that's when the lady said fuck it and moved out of Park City with her boyfriend and her daughter. But, you know, in a gender discrimination lawsuit that was filed in federal court, Raider's co-worker Mary Capps, she worked under Raider from 98 until when he was arrested in 05, said that he was a terrible boss. He was cold, demanding, and degrading. She talks about an incident there. She was trapped in her office and chased around the room by Dennis, and she was terrified. She said that she complained weekly to Raider's supervisor about his behavior, but it was all dismissed or simply referred back to Raider himself. Three formal complaints to the park, you know, to Park City. There, you know, the city procedures, they were channeled to her supervisor, Dennis Raider, who of course did nothing. There were media reports after the arrest stating that Capps may have been drugged repeatedly with animal tranquilizers while working with Raider. But, you know, this was not mentioned in the lawsuit, and a federal judge dismissed the lawsuit, saying it was not filed within the time limits. So, yeah, that's kind of nuts. During the 90s, Raider served on two local boards in Park City. In 96, his father, William, died of natural causes. His mother, Dorothea, began staying in a nursing home or at home with her son Jeff. Raider's daughter Carrie attended K-State University, whose football team he was a huge fan of. So in 03, Carrie married a man from Michigan, and they, you know, went to live there. Brian, his son, was in the Navy and was in the East Coast. So Raider was very involved in the church, and he was elected to be on the church council and assumed the position of vice president in January 2004. According to their church procedure, the vice president becomes council president after 1 year. The Raiders remained quite active in their Lutheran church, with Dennis, of course, being this trusted leader, and he was a helper and an usher and, you know, had all of these different responsibilities within the church. So with the kids gone, you know, he was increasingly bored. You know, at this point, the online crime library had published an article about the unsolved BTK case, which everyone thought BTK was dead. Or maybe he was jailed, or, you know, he left Wichita, or, you know, there was just this whole deal. So at this point, there's, you know, a bunch of Wichitans, as they refer to themselves, that they grew up and they didn't really know the BTK case. They didn't know the terror that had been dealt with by their parents and grandparents. And so Raider kind of thought about, you know, reemerging, coming back, doing his, you know, last lap, as you will. So Wichita lawyer named Robert Beatty was concerned that the BTK case was being forgotten and set out to write a book about the investigation. And, you know, there's an investigation team called the Ghostbusters that actually tried very, very, very hard to, capture Dennis. And it's just, it's insane how he wasn't caught. But so he, you know, even though the last murder occurred in 1977, well, last known murder, I should say, BTK was attributed with 7 murders and the attempt on Anna Williams, the one who, you know, left town because of him. Beatty was responsible for renewing the interest in the BTK case as early as 2003. And, on the internet, the case started being discussed again. January 2004 was the 30th anniversary of the Otero murders, and the Wichita Eagle ran an article about the crime and the BTK killer. So, it was a mix of the anniversary article and this book, announcement that it caught Dennis's attention. And he was kind of pissed that someone else was going to be telling his story. And so his plans for eventual reemergence, like, sped up. They went from 0 to 100 right quick. So, as Dennis is, like, pissed and trying to figure out what he's going to do, it took him a couple months. But then on March 17th, he mailed an envelope to the Wichita Eagle from Bill Thomas Kilman. It contained 3 photocopies, pictures of his own photos of Vicki Wegerle as she lay dying in 1986, as well as a photocopy of her missing driver's license. He signed it with the BTK symbol he had used in previous letters in the 70s. The letter was forwarded to the FBI, who had confirmed its authenticity as a BTK communication. And the, that cold case was solved, but the uproar had, it just started. Because now, he is kind of announcing, hey, guess what? I'm dead, y'all. I'm here, bitches. So, Rader sends another letter on May 5th of 2004 to the studio KAKE. And it is a, gigantic word puzzle. And it's, columns of letters and numbers. And, the FBI verified that this also came from BTK because he had used his unique signature of a B that was made to look like breasts, and a T and a K mixed together, which essentially looked like breasts with arms that were extended out and legs that were spread. And it's just odd, but that's the thing, I guess. So nobody could make any sense out of the puzzle. On June 9th of 2004, a package was taped to a stop sign on the corner of First and Kansas Streets in the middle of the city of Wichita. It contained a completely fucked up collection of documents, including a letter detailing the horrific murders of the Otero family and a sketch of Josie Otero, being bound and hanging by the rope in the basement. That sketch was labeled as "The Sexual Thrill Is My Bill," which is just completely fucked up. So there's an enclosed, there was an enclosed chapter list for the BTK story. It mimicked a chapter list of David Lohr's original article that was about BTK on the online crime library. Chapter 1 was entitled "A Serial Killer Is Born." July 17th, 2004, a package marked BTK was found in a book return at the Wichita Public Library. And it came, contained a message that was made you kind of worried. Says, "I have spotted a female that I think lives alone and or is a spotted latchkey kid. I just got to work out the details. I am much older, but not feeble now, and have to work it. And have to condition myself carefully. Also, my thinking process is not as sharp as it uses to be. I think fall or winter would be just about right for the hit. got to do it this year or next. Time is running out for me. Of course, that was full of typos and misspellings. So, you know, there's this package that, you know, in this package, there is this claim that BTK had engineered the death of a 19-year-old man from Argonia, Kansas, named Jake Allen. Jake Allen actually had committed suicide by lying on the railroad tracks. And, you know, BTK tried to say that he lured the man there via a series of computer chats. You know, it was disproven as a hoax. And there's no evidence that, you know, Jake Allen had ever had internet chats with anyone. And so his death is still seen as a suicide. So the public doesn't know what's going on. The police is refusing to release a lot of details from these packages. And, you know, it's just because they were scared that it would lead BTK into a killing frenzy. So a fifth drop of, you know, packages and, you know, these special BTK letters didn't occur until October 22nd, 2004, when a UPS worker found a strange manila envelope while picking up the contents of the UPS box in the Omni Center by 2nd and Kansas Streets. This consisted of a very disturbing assortment of cards that had images pasted on them, including one of a bound woman with a look of sheer terror on her face. One card contained a poem called Death to Landwehr, a reference to Lieutenant Ken Landwehr, who was the head of the BTK investigation and had been working the case, you know, for a very, very, very long time. He had actually heard about these murders when he was a teenager, and there was a case that stuck with him, so he worked on it, you know, until the end. You know, there's also a collage of children, these pictures of children with bindings drawn on their bodies and their faces. The envelope also contained what, you know, Dennis called his autobiography, listing a number of details about his life, being born in 1939, his father dying in the war, mother dating a railroad detective, and so on. So, of course, it's all complete fallacy. He also claimed to be fascinated with railroads and usually lived near railroad tracks. Almost all of it was, you know, of course, a lie. And he is trying to mislead police into researching false clues. The police did release the autobiography to the public a few weeks later, which, you know, that excited Dennis. He was all about that. What the Wichita Police Department was actually doing was following the FBI's advice that they had gotten to keep the killer communicating and don't offend him in the public. Don't overexcite him into killing some more. Just keep him talking until he makes a mistake. So December 1st, 2004, officers of Wichita Police Department stormed the house of Roger Valdez, who lived in a house in Wichita with peeling paint within sight of railroad tracks. He was held on a minor outstanding warrant, but apparently was suspected of being BTK, although a DNA test quickly exonerated him. Ultimately, the police would take in some 1,300 DNA swabs of men while they searched for a match to the BTK semen that was left at crime scenes. I believe in the book they called it the Great Swabathon. Raider's sixth drop of, you know, these very special packages was December 14th in 2004. A man was walking through Murdoch Park that night and noticed a container or a package wrapped with a white It was wrapped in white plastic leaning against a tree. So he took it home with him and he opened it, and it contained a project doll. The doll's head had a plastic bag tied over it. Its hands were tied behind its back and its feet were bound together. And tied to the feet was the actual driver's license belonging to BTK murder victim Nancy Fox, whom he had killed in December of 1977. So the man immediately notifies KAKE-TV, who comes and photographs the contents and notifies the police. KAKE agreed not to broadcast what was found in the package for fear of arousing the killer. January 1st, 2005, Dennis officially becomes the new president of the church council at Christ Lutheran Church in Wichita because, you know, of his election of the vice presidency of the previous year. 8 days into the new year, Dennis left a special K cereal box marked BTK and bomb in the bed of a pickup truck parked at a Home Depot on North Woodlawn. The truck belonged to an employee of the Home Depot, and he thought it was trash and put it in his trash can at home. Luckily, his wife had thrown a discarded pillow on top of the box, and it actually preserved it, which was pretty darn lucky considering, you know, its significance. So, you know, there was another letter left by BTK that was like, hey, where's the box from where's the special K box, you know? So it ended up with the police going to that Home Depot, because he had made mention of it being left in the Home Depot, in a truck in the Home Depot parking lot. So he, you know, was like, hey, you know, where's this drop at? You know, where's my stuff? You guys haven't reported on that one. So when the guy who had thrown it away at his house came back, he had been on vacation, and was worried that the trash had already been taken out. Well, it had not. So he was able to take the box to the police, and the police reviewed the surveillance tape of the parking lot, and had their very first glimpse of BTK. The image was very far away and very grainy and blurry, but they were able to measure the wheelbase of the black vehicle he was driving and determined that it was a Jeep Grand Cherokee. And Raider, you know, kind of, I guess he forgot that, you know, surveillance cameras had become commonplace because he didn't take any care really to, you know, disguise himself, as he had left this box in this guy's car. So this box had info about some of his, you know, projects or intended victims that he had watched or stalked. And it also contained more misleading information on how he lived in a 3-story home in Wichita with an elevator that had a bomb in the basement rigged to explode if the house were invaded. Raider also asked a peculiar question to the detectives, that if he put his writings on a computer disk, like a floppy disk, if you're a younger listener, first off, if you're under 18 and listening, you know, I am not responsible for your therapy for choosing to listen to my podcast, because obviously I curse and the shit I talk about is pretty fucked up. So, not responsible for your therapy. Also, a floppy disk is a, Google it. It is a square and it has like a little silver circle in the middle and like a little plastic doohickey up in the top. And that is what we would use before CDs and DVDs to store information on. So just the fact that I have to explain that kind of makes me want to die a little bit. But he had asked if he could be traced if he used a floppy disk. So He also requested that a response be posted in the Wichita Eagle, in the classifieds, in the miscellaneous category using a code name Rex. So, an eighth drop was in another cereal box from the, quote, serial killer. Okay, I love a good pun. But this is kind of, I mean, given the fact that he's actually a murderer, it's pretty fucked up. But also, the dark humor part of me really kind of is just like, serial killer. Anyway, so it's a post-toasties box. And it's discovered on January 25th of 2005. And it is the result of a tip from drop 9, which was a postcard sent to KAKE from S. Killett, using the address of the Otero House as the return address. It mentioned the post-toasties box and the drop at Home Depot, you know, which found the Special K box. The post-toasties box was found leaning against a road sign on an unpaved section of North Seneca to the north of Wichita City limits. KAKE videotaped the box without touching it and notified the police. It had a brick taped to the top of it and appeared weathered. So, when they opened it up, the police officers opened it up, it was a Barbie doll with a rope tied around its neck and tied to a plumbing fixture to depict little 11-year-old Josephine Otero, which is completely fucked. A 10th drop was another postcard that arrived on February 3rd, sent to KAKE. Return address was Hap Cakeman, a 50s character from KAKE's past. Raider wrote, "Thank you for your quick response on number 7 and 8. Thanks to the news team for their efforts. Sorry about Susan and Jeff's colds. Business issues. Tell WPD that I received newspaper tip for a go. Test run soon. Thanks. P.S. May want to use KTV-PC-ETC code pound and letters from me for my verification code to you." He's referring to the newspaper ad in the Wichita Eagle placed there by detectives to question or answer his question about the safety of sending a floppy disk. The responding ad had assured him an agreement upon the code Rex, it'll be okay. Drop 11 arrives at the studios of KSAS-TV on February 16th, a Fox affiliate in Wichita, and contained a letter, a piece of jewelry, and a purple diskette referred to as test floppy for WPD review. Detectives didn't waste any time. They analyzed the diskette and they found software on it from Christ Lutheran Church in Wichita, and the name Dennis Rader had, he thought he had erased all the original contents from it and that it would be, quote, safe to use for his purposes. So the cops hop on the internet and they do a little Google and they find the church and mentioned its current president, Dennis Rader, and a group of detectives drive by Rader's house in Park City and they see the black Jeep Cherokee. That's parked in the driveway. Rader was placed under surveillance while they get a subpoena, and they secretly obtain a DNA sample from his daughter, a pap smear slide from when she went to K-State, was used to get a familial match from Carrie Rader to, confirm that Dennis was the one who murdered all of these people, given the fact that he was a secretor, he left semen, you know, there was nail or stuff collected from under the nails of Miss Waggerly. And even though the news reports said that Carrie Rader turned in her father, she actually didn't know. She didn't know that the police had gotten these DNA samples from her medical records. She didn't know that her dad was BTK. And in her book that she wrote about this, she discusses her childhood. She discusses the one time that, or I'm sorry, the two times that her dad went after her brother and tried to choke him. Sometimes where they had, the parents had some marital issues because Dennis was pretty controlling and stuff, but she figured she had a pretty, general generic upbringing. So she was asked to submit a DNA sample in her home in Michigan, and after the arrest, she didn't know until later that yes, it was her DNA that was directly used to solve the BTK case. So February 25th, 2005, Dennis, would always leave work at lunchtime to go eat with it, lunch with his wife, and so he leaves the office. He's driving on his way home, and then he noticed that he is completely surrounded by police, and it's not just a couple of them, it's a bunch of cops. And so he surrenders quietly and gets led into a police car, and he's handcuffed, read his rights, everything, gets put inside the car. Before he was actually put inside the car, he said, "Could you please let my wife know that I will be late for lunch? I assume you know where I live." So when he is put into the car, he says, "Hello, Mr. Landwehr." And Lieutenant Ken Landwehr responds with, "Hello, Mr. Raider."
Okay, also, we're going to leave off at this point. Dennis Rader, BTK killer, has been arrested. And to find out what happens next, y'all are gonna have to come back for part two. Because this is already essentially movie length. So we're splitting her up into two parts. So yeah, y'all come back for part two. Hope you gorgeous weirdos have a lovely day. And stay safe. And yeah, get to hooking. Bye.